I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, this weekend, Los Angeles saw National Guard troops clash with anti-ICE protesters. Here in San Antonio, there's a local protest against ICE arresting people at immigration court. How effective, though, are protests? How do rallies, marches, and other forms of public dissent impact public policy? What are the best practices for making a protest have power, especially against an administration that seems unmoved by the mass display of opposition? The new book, The Protest History of the United States, tells the story of how the nation was built on protest and how many of the rights that we enjoy today were the results of the acts of protest. Gloria Brown Marshall joins us to explain why protests matter. This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source. But first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Across the nation, there have been a growing number of protest marches and rallies. The demonstrators are largely voicing their dissent against the Trump administration. But what are these protests about largely? Well, there's racial justice and anti-black police violence, reproductive rights, abortion, gun violence, labor, economic inequality, climate change, environmental justice, defunding SNAP and Medicaid, immigration and border policy, LGBTQ plus rights, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, voting rights and democracy, education, and book bans. There's a famous quote from the 1953 movie The Wild Ones, spoken by Marlon Brando's character Johnny. Someone asked Johnny, "Johnny, what are you rebelling against?" And Brando says, "What do you got?" It seems like there are many reasons now to make a sign and take to the streets and demand change, but does this work? Do protests make change? In the new book, A Protest History of the United States, Gloria Brown Marshall makes the case that protests are a powerful tool for positive, long-lasting change, but it's not easy. It's hard, it can be painful, and sometimes it can be deadly. Gloria Brown Marshall, welcome to The Source.
Thank you.
What are you seeing when you're watching the coverage of these protests happening in LA and elsewhere across the country? What do you see?
I see people frustrated. And when you don't have avenues for change and there's no dialogue, then that means that people take to the streets and they take out their frustration against the powers that be oppressing them. And so I see that frustration and I see the passion and the anger and the pain of people who believe they have certain rights or they should have certain rights and that those rights are not being respected.
What did the founding fathers think about protest?
The founding fathers actually gave us, the people, the right to protest. The word protest is not in the Constitution. We make up our protest rights out of the First Amendment. We all know freedom of speech and freedom of assembly, but the last line of the First Amendment gives us the right, and I quote, to petition the government for a redress of grievances, to petition to ask the government for a redress, a remedy of grievances, complaints. So we have in the last line of the First Amendment the right to ask the government to make the changes that we need or we feel we should have.
Watching a clip from the protest in L.A. this weekend, I see police officers with their bullhorns saying, "This is an unlawful assembly. Please, or you better disperse." I don't know if they said please or not. But what decides it's an unlawful assembly?
Well, civil disobedience has always been a part of the human experience. When there is not a law or a protection that says that one can speak up or act in a certain way to defend themselves, and they do so without the cover of law, and that's civil disobedience. Or they may believe that they are intentionally not following what they consider an unjust law for what they believe are just reasons. And so a civilly sanctioned protest is one in which in the US that you would go to whatever the governing authority is and ask for a permit. And the permit, it would state what people wanted to do, where they wanted to do it, what the time frame was going to be, how many people would be there. And then the government is supposed to protect the actions of protests based on that permit. Civil disobedience is when people don't seek out a permit or they go beyond the permit that they've been given. And they want to do so in a way to show the government that they don't believe the government's actions should be respected.
Well, it does seem like protesters, and protest is a very large word, so I'm going to try and narrow that down to these marches or these demonstrations. And we'll get into all the different ways of doing protests in a bit. But these marches and demonstrations, they are demonstrating that they disagree with public policy. And they sometimes do want to disrupt the peace. And is that legitimate?
Yes. One of the things that comes with protests, and we'll, as you said, we'll get to the more broader way of looking at and applying the idea and concept of protest. But in looking at it from the narrow standpoint of what happens when people take to the streets, they are saying to whatever the opposing governmental, and usually governmental, or it could be an, you know, a job or, you know, manufacturer, corporation, whatever it may be, but some entity that's in a position of power, that they don't want to or believe that they should have to follow rules that are harmful. And so they're making their voices heard because they believe that there's not a channel by which their voices can be heard or need to be heard in that very important time frame. Say, for example, those same people could say, I want to go speak to my governmental officials. I can make an appointment 3 weeks from now to have my voice heard, but that's not going to meet the moment. And so in order to meet that moment, they believe in others who stand, you know, shoulder to shoulder with them, that they need to act then, and they need to act as quickly as possible and use the sometimes force to collide with the government that is standing in their way or preventing them from having what they believe are their rights realized.
So they chant, no justice, no peace, but you have someone like President Donald Trump saying this is we need law and order, and so we need to shut this down. That seems like we have a conflict.
And it's really a bare conflict, because this is the same person, you get to the hypocrisy of it all, who didn't see any problem with people attacking the Capitol, scaling the walls, breaking the windows, using, you know, bear spray and everything else. And what we saw as an insurrection and a criminal action, he didn't see that as insurrection. He didn't see that as rebellion. So that's another issue that people have. When the government is sending these mixed messages, when it's asking people to follow the law but not following the law itself, that's another trigger for protest. So, you know, the message that was sent by this particular government administration was that, you know, people who violate the laws, if they do so in support of the policies or ideology of this administration, then it's fine. But people doing the same things in support of something that they believe is important to them, it's not. And that's a violation. And that's, you know, and we're going to use governmental forces to crush it. So that by itself is something that could trigger protest. In this particular instance, no justice, no peace is just one phrase. Each generation comes up with its own phrases for why it's going to oppose the government. And no peace is one of the ways in which protests can actually work, because in taking away the peace is forcing society, community, wherever it may be, to pay attention to the issues that the protesters believe are important, not just for that individual protester, but indirectly to the rest of the community as well.
I used to hear them chant, this is what democracy looks like. Now I'm hearing them chanting, this is what fascism looks like. We're going to continue our conversation discussing the new book by Gloria Brown Marshall, A Protest History of the United States. Do you protest? Do you want to go protest? Or you're just kind of like, well, maybe not now. What are you waiting for? What's going to make you get out there and do something, and a march or a boycott or a walkout or a sit-in or a die-in? What do you want to do? What kind of protest? What do you think works? Do you think protests work? Give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK, and The Source continues.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With me on the line is Gloria Brown Marshall. She's a professor of constitutional law and Africana studies at John Jay College, an award-winning writer and legal commentator. She has litigated cases for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, the Southern Poverty Law Center, and Community Legal Services. Her previous books include She Took Justice, The Black Women, Law and Power, and The Voting Rights Law. That's just a little bit of what she does. Incredible biography, a resume here. Gloria, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about your book, A Protest History of the United States. And our phone lines are open. If you've got a question about protest, what are the best practices for a protest? What are some mistakes protests make that dull their impact? 833-TPR-TALK, 833-877-8255. I really do want to find out, what are the best practices? What makes a protest really effective, Gloria Brown Marshall?
I think there are many different ways, depending on the circumstances, but it has to be this idea that you go in with a plan. And this is what's making me rather concerned right now. We see these spontaneous protests that are taking place, but where's the plan of action? During labor movements, the civil rights movement, in the women's movement, even the anti-war movements of the past, there were plans as to how people were going to use their human resources, where they were going to go, how long they would be there, and what they thought would be the end result. So a successful protest to me is that we have an idea. We're going to go into this particular place, say it's a sit-in. You're going into, and I'm just going to use this, and I don't want to offend anyone. Then you go into a major chain store like Trader Joe's, and you say, we're going to have a sit-in here during this time period. We're going to have 20 people. We have somebody who has the bail money if there is an arrest. We have a card in each person's hand. They know whom to call if they are arrested. One of the things that took place when I had a chance to visit during the 60th anniversary of the Edmund Pettus Bridge voting rights marches, those were young people, high school students, who met every week to plan the protest actions they were participating in. There was planning here, strategy. And I think that's what makes a difference with a successful protest. There is a strategy in mind of how the protest is going to take place. What is it that the protesters want to accomplish with that particular protest that's also part of an overarching effective way in which they want to move the needle and affect the government policies or the laws that are in place, for example, voting rights? They would go to the voting registrar and say, we want to vote. There would be maybe 20 to 75 people lined up. They had all the paperwork needed to vote. They knew they were going to be turned away, but they also had press there. So media is very important, that people know that you're having this action and why you're having this action. I've gone to protests where there's no materials handed out. I have no idea, outside of the sign somebody is carrying, what they want the government to do or what they want me as a bystander looking at this action to actually do. So I think it's important to convey the message. The other is that people get home safely. They must get home safely. If that is the act at the end, to get home safely, if it is to be arrested, then can they be arrested safely? During the nonviolent protests, they actually took classes in how to be a nonviolent protester. There was a philosophy behind it. So although it's good that people are protesting, I think that there is much more strategically that could be done with protests to make them more effective.
So a list of demands saying, we're having a protest because we want ICE to leave immigration court alone, just hands off immigration court. Having a clear message like that, because frequently here, the people complaining, like, these people don't even know what they're protesting about. And that may or may not be true, but that's that doesn't have to be the case.
It doesn't. If there's someone and it, from just a placard and somebody else is handing out leaflets, you know, because that way people could take that home, study it, think about it, as opposed to that one moment. I remember being in my car in New York City on West Side Highway, and there was a flash mob that stopped all traffic on West Side Highway. And the issue was, of course, police-involved civilian violence during that time period after the murder of George Floyd. And so, you know, and so that came up, that it made the radio, it made the other news reports, it stopped traffic, and that's a lot of traffic to stop. But it took a lot of people to do that. They had communication. And they said later, they were chanting what they wanted. You know, they, you know, a lot of this could have been, some people said defund the police or whatever. But the idea that there was a message that was conveyed as to why people are doing what they're doing. Even Occupy Wall Street, that was one where you had so many different people in, you know, the Wall Street area with so many different messages that it was not understood. They were all kind of conflated as to what somebody actually wanted the individual to do. The rest of the people out who are watching the protests have power, as those protesters have power, and the people watching it can say, you're asking me to do something. You have stopped my car on West Side Highway because you want me to know that you have an issue here and then go do something. That thing called do something, the action, the activity of activism, I think that's what's being lost here. And that's what makes an effective protest in the end, because you want the outside people who are always going to be in a greater number than the protesters to actually do something, make a call, tell their government to make a change, vote a certain way. There's something that you want the outside person to do. And I think that's not being articulated well enough right now.
Let's go to the phone lines. Our number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And Daniel, you're on the air with Gloria Brown Marshall. Go ahead.
First of all, ditto to everything Ms. Marshall is saying. I agree 100%. I was at the ICE protest yesterday downtown, and I think it's important to be there and demonstrate. And of course, it's not going to always be the complete answer to everything. However, as an individual person, I felt empowered to be with other people to just get all the frustration out of my mind. And it felt good to be outdoors, even though too hot, and to express how I felt. And if that's all it accomplished for my own mental, psychological well-being, great. Because the one thing that angers me the most is all the false premises that Trump and his administration use to base an action. For example, he said in Los Angeles that they were all insurrectionists and professional this and that. He doesn't know that. And usually whatever his false premise is followed by this huge conversation about what needs to be done about it according to him. And again, you can fill in that false premise blank with anything you want. He'll throw out something, right, and people are so angered and off into a conversation without even ever challenging the false premise. For example, what happened on January 6th, didn't police officers die? Isn't the Republican yes. Party the party of laws, et cetera, et cetera? Hypocrisy okay. isn't a big enough word to describe them. So I let my frustrations out. I'm home safely. I'm glad it was peaceful. I'm an older person, and to be out there, the oldest protester was 83 years old, and he made the whole march after the demonstration at City Hall. Right. And there was about 900 people. The media locally always underplays a small gathering or 100 people or whatever. And there may have been more than 900, but there was a lot of people. It really doesn't matter.
So, Daniel, thank you so much. We got to cover what you just talked about. I appreciate you calling in with these thoughts. So to the point that Daniel made, that he felt – compelled to go out and protest this weekend because he was frustrated, he was emotionally charged, but basically it was an emotional outburst, not strategic. Is that what your takeaway?
What I took away first and foremost was he used the word empowered. And that is what happens with a protest. And what I wanted to also capture in my book, A Protest History of the United States, when people come together shoulder to shoulder and they have this common cause, there is an empowerment there. And it's truly something spiritual. And I think it's necessary because all of that, could it be rage, he said, and could be frustration, all of that just turns inside of us. And if we have a chance to actually give it voice, in a way that's peaceful, that you can go out into your community with others who are feeling frustrated and maybe enraged by the opposition and the horrible politics that are taking place, and give voice to it. It's necessary for us to not just leave all of that rage inside to let it churn. The other is, yes, there were over 900 people, and the media plays down the number of people who protest. But also, I think it's necessary for us to see those protests were taking place all around the country. So there was like some symbol of strategic planning to it, because there were other protests that were taking place. It wasn't just that one isolated. And even if it is, we in this country, we have isolated protests all the time, as opposed in Europe. They're very strategic in their planning their protests. I've been there where they've had protests of, you know, the transit workers and others, where here we have spontaneous protests that take place all the time. But that planned protest, I think, was not given enough media attention.
Well, who says there's 900? Who says there's 200? I mean, if the organizers of the protest were able to have an objective number that they were able to produce, we would have someone to source and say, according to protesters, who they have this number. Otherwise, you just have a reporter who is just looking around and says, well, it looks like 200 people to me. I'm going to call it 200. You know, you need... like you talked about Occupy, one of the frustrations I had about covering Occupy is that they refused even to allow to have a spokesperson. We don't want to have anyone in charge. We don't have a spokesperson. It's like, well, I mean, who do I quote? How do I figure the story out? What do I put in it? I have nothing to work with. So therefore, you guys are a bunch of clowns. You know, you got to have some people who are able to call the shots.
And I did a panel on what makes an effective protest at Harvard. And that question came up, you know, and that was in April, I believe. But the idea that younger generations don't want to have that centralized, this is the leader of the protest. I think it's necessary because somebody, even if they're not the leader, they should be the person who's going to act as a communicator of the issue to the rest of the world. And I think that's what's being lost here, and it's undermining the effectiveness of the cause. You have to be able to communicate what it is you want and make sure you say what it is your demands are. You know, this is the reason why we are here protesting. And I would back up a little bit about deriding them as not having seriousness about their efforts. They have a different way of looking at it. They don't want to have that kind of system with a leader. And I'm going to tell you something that I've heard many times from young people. They have watched leaders assassinated. They have watched leaders destroyed economically. You know, they've watched leaders get kicked out of school and not able to graduate. And so that we've sent a message, other generations have sent a message. If you have a leader, that leader is going to be an object of the governmental forces. And so they've decided, a lot of the younger people, we're not going to have a designated leader because that's going to be the person who's going to be picked off easily.
Well, the media works under certain rules, as you know. We have to have sources. We have to attribute things. And if they're going to be at a disadvantage if they don't want to, you know, work on with those rules.
It's true. We haven't figured out that. I've seen the middle ground, and the young people I've talked with haven't done that as far as an individual. What they want to do is perhaps send something out on social media, but then you don't know with social media if that's like a reliable source, if that's the source of them at all, you know. But I think it's difficult now as people are finding their way between this hybrid of human experience and social media, internet experience, and how they're going to convey their points.
Okay, here, we're going to take another break. I got Rebecca on the phone board, and I'll get you on the air when we come back from the break, Rebecca. And if you want to join the conversation, we definitely want to hear from people who have been joining these protests. What brought you out there, and what do you think was accomplished? Have you not gone to protest? Are you just refusing not to go? Are you on the fence? Are you waiting for something to motivate you to go? Well, what is that thing? When do you know it's time to go? And the number to call in is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Or do you think these protesters, you're not a fan, and you think that this is not how you get change? Well, we want to hear from you as well, 833-877-8255. We'll continue talking with Gloria Brown Marshall about her new book, A Protest History of the United States. We're going to find out more about the book when we come back from the break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the new book, A Protest History of the United States, joined by the author Gloria Brown Marshall. If you have a question, give us a call, 833-877-8255. Have you been joining these protests? Have you been wanting to but haven't? What's holding you back? Give us a call. Let's go to Rebecca. And Rebecca, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah. I appreciate this interview a lot. I really do. I am definitely going to protest because it's the only way I can deal with the bad news that we hear every day. It's so frustrating, and we have so little control. That protesting is helpful to me. And also, protesting is a way of telling the administration, we're not happy with this. We're not going to acquiesce. This is not normal behavior. When we stop protesting, that means we're accepting the administration's behavior. Another thing that I do is I use the Five Calls app. And I can be very specific when I call my congresspeople. Five Calls app is a great way to protest as well.
Rebecca, thank you so much. So the classic protest song, Which Side Are You On, Gloria, that's how you decide, you know, which side are you on?
Well, I'm not quite sure what the question is, but I would like to go to what she said, what the caller said. Thank you, Jessica, because one of the things I saw when I was researching the protest history of the United States is that looking over centuries of time, I began with the indigenous resistance mm-hmm. over their land and culture, to slave uprisings, into anti-war and women's protests, you know, all the way to police-involved civilian violence. And when I look at them, there are particular patterns that I see that take place, and that is that laws are enacted by the powerful against people they believe are just going to accept those laws. Most people do. So it's not going to include everyone in a protest. There's going to be a certain fraction of people who are going to rise up. It's going to start off small, and then it's going to build. And so when people go, well, why isn't my neighbor protesting? Why isn't everybody else out there? It's never been everybody. It's always going to be a certain fraction of people. And so if we're looking for all the people to come out and we're waiting for all the people to come out, then you'll never have a time period in which you want to step into the fray. Yes, it can be dangerous. Yes, that's why I said at the end, do people get home safely? Because you are putting yourself in harm's way, especially with this regime. This country believes in hurting its citizens. It has hurt its citizens from the very beginning. But the framers gave us not just three branches of government, but gave us the right to petition the government for a redress of grievances. It feared the regime we have right now. And I, as a constitutional scholar, have looked at this from different angles. And I believe what we have right now is exactly what the framers feared. But they gave the people the right to protest against their own government. And so I think that last balance is what this country must rely on until it can right itself between these three branches of government.
All right, another caller. Let's go to Jennifer. And hi, Jennifer, you're on the air.
Hi. I apologize if this is a stupid question, but earlier the author mentioned that in organized protests of the past, that the people had a card in their hand of who to call for bail if they got arrested, and that they had raised this bail. And there's so many protests that I would go to if I could. Protesters that are out there, only the ones that can afford to bail themselves out are where I'm just curious. Are there organizations, I mean, the labor unions, but I'm assuming labor unions would only bail out their members. I think there's a lot of people that would, including myself, that don't go to protests that would if it weren't for the fear of the cost of getting arrested.
Jennifer, thank you so much. I think that's a good question. I appreciate you calling in with that. And Gloria?
That's a great question. Oh, your callers are on fire. here's the thing. The ACLU has a website about protesting. So you can go to the ACLU website and look at some of these rules for protesting. It's not rules, I would say, but some of the advice about protesting. I would say you can form your own group and have your own group with that somebody stays home. I always say, don't have the lawyers out protesting unless there's going to be a lawyer staying home to take the calls if somebody gets arrested. So I think that you could put your own pot of money together. And I always say to my friends, you know, do you have the bail money ready just in case I need it? I think it's necessary for you, even if it's not another group like the ACLU or whatever your local group may be, that your group, whatever group you belong to, can put some money together that will be the bail money that would make others feel more secure about going out and protesting. And then know who that lawyer may be in the group, you know, that's going to stay home, be by the phone, and be able to take the calls in case people are arrested. You can create that yourselves. And that's the other part of a protest that makes it effective. It's creativity. Creativity. Think out of the box. Because if there's a saying, you can't use the master's tools to tear down the master's house. You have to come up with your own creative tools. This regime has studied us using our own federal tax money against us, our own National Guard against us. That means we've got to figure out how to be creative in this particular very intense atmosphere and in our own communities, coming up with ways in which we have our cards written down, we have our sources, we have money that's been gathered, people can contribute. What happened to a protest I participated in is that there were people who didn't want to go to the protest, but they decided they would put their money in. Some people made sandwiches. Other people made signs. There's all different ways in which people can contribute, and more people will participate once they see a role they can take within the protest.
Well, I might be demonstrating my privilege as a white male, but I mean, there are worse things than being arrested and spending a couple of nights in jail. I don't really think that's that awful.
Well, and then you are working on your privilege, because depending on the jail, it could be a very frightening experience. And I think that having our freedoms being taken away is an important point. And when people are putting themselves in jeopardy, it means a lot. Right now, we have people who are sitting out as though this is some type of reality show, waiting to see what happens until it lands on their steps. And little by little, that's what's happening. We know that the National Guard, the National Guard was going to be called out sometime. And I thought it would be this summer, because in the first administration, Donald Trump said he was going to call out the National Guard into Black communities, you know, if there was any gang violence or if there was any urban uprising around the killing of Black people by police. So these are people waiting to use force. And we were talking about getting arrested. We're talking about people in putting themselves in vulnerable positions. To me, it's very serious. It's not just about, you know, some pleasant place like TV jail. You know, I remember people who got arrested protesting during COVID, and there were no masks in the jails. And so they're very unpleasant, an open toilet, all of this. So it's not a pleasant experience, but it is an experience that Martin Luther King said, you know, he had been arrested dozens of times, that he got tired of being arrested. There's something about the vulnerability of it that is something that no one wants to, you know, actively experience. So the sacrifice that people are making, if they're willing to be arrested, has to be looked at gravely and seriously and with great respect.
Let's go to John on the phones. And John, thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Yeah, I'm 82 years old, and I want to jump into the fray, as you say. And I'm going to go to the ACLU website, and I'm going to but I want to contribute somehow to the protest movement in this San Antonio. And I want to know how you're going to communicate with me.
Communicate how, John? With what?
Well, is it going to be announced on the radio that there's going to be a protest at such and such a time? And will I be able to go and stay in the heat, you know, expose myself to the heat outside? Or am I going to participate some other way?
Yeah. Well, John, thank you for the call. I appreciate that.
Well, there's going to be a protest, I know, a nationwide protest called No King's Day on June 14th. I know that is something that's taking place across the country, No King's Day protest. So that's something you can look up. There are also groups. I'm not a part of some of these groups. There are groups in different places that have been created that started to have, you know, branches, you know, in different states. So you can go online and look at that. But going online, this is when social media is helpful, is going online and looking at some of these national groups. And they're holding meetings every week. And as I said, you know, if you're not the one who's feeling up to being out in the heat, maybe you're one who wants to make the signs at home that are given to other people, or help pay for the signs to be made that are given to other people. There are many ways in which people can be a part of the cause.
You can write a letter to the editor.
Yes, thank you so much. And to petition, petitions take so many different ways. I truly believe right now, since everything is by email, writing handwritten or paper letters to your public officials, because they don't get those types of letters anymore. So to be able to have a deluge of these letters to public officials is something that's very important. Emails can be deleted or ignored, but to have paper letters coming in, and if people actually sent in these letters, stamped letters using the post office to their public officials, it makes a big impact. That's why I said, think creatively. How can you make an impact on people using systems that they have, or using older systems that will then, you know, give notice to your cause?
Taking one more break. We'll be right back hearing more from Gloria Brown Marshall about her book, A Protest History of the United States. We invite your calls. Do you protest? How do you want to protest? What do you think can be done with the power of protest? What are the limitations of protest? Give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source continues after this. This is The Source from Texas Public Radio, A Protest History of the United States, new book by Gloria Brown Marshall. You can call in with your questions and comments, 833-877-8255. Gloria, you mentioned in the book the Bacon Scheller strike of San Antonio, 1938, with Emma Tenayuca, and how that was an important strike in the labor movement. And so I saw that there and felt seen, having the San Antonio protest there.
Yes, and there's so many ways in which protests have happened that we've forgotten about them. And so my book is over 400 years of time, but it also can, of course, cannot include all these different protests. So I have protest examples that are indicative of the types of protests, and that one involving the women. And people don't know about the role that women played in protests, because they were given these jobs, and they stood up for themselves, just like the mill girls stood up for themselves in Maine and New Hampshire back in the early 1800s. Women have played a major role. And in the women's chapter, I speak not just of women's rights, but the woman's right in her protection of her body, and how that has been a movement that doesn't get enough attention. I want, if you don't mind, this very quick example for people to understand the power of protest. We've had this Constitution. We've had the Equal Protection Clause and Due Process Clause in 1868 in the 14th Amendment, but it was protest, litigation, legislation, and protest with a vision that gave us the rights we have today, that made them real. We could have rights on paper, but it was when the protests happened. And for example, in 1868, we were given by law the 8-hour workday. But it took decades for that to be realized. And that was decades of protest. So it's not going to be a one and done in most instances. It's going to be protest over time. But so much of what we have, we've gained by protest, but we've forgotten, just like the pecan strike, we've forgotten about the gains that were made in the people's lives and livelihoods who were lost in order for us to have the rights we have today.
So does that seem to be one of the biggest issues that people have, their expectations of how a protest can bring about change, that it has to be, it just takes a long time. You know, the civil rights movement took years and years and years. It didn't happen at the Edmund Pettus Bridge over and over again. It took so much.
It did. And so people see the Edmund Pettus Bridge and they then conflate everything that happened before that into that moment and say, oh, and that's how we got the 1965 Voting Rights Act. But there's so much more that happened. And so people want that protest is going to trigger the change. The change happens. Everybody's happy. They can go home and say it was an effective or successful protest. And usually things take time. You have to get the other stakeholders involved. And this is the problem. Where are the stakeholders who are sympathetic to the cause but haven't been pulled into it? If we don't want to have a particular corporation just ignore our issues and our concerns, then force them to take a stand by perhaps not buying from them.
The boycott protest.
Yes, but I don't want to use the word boycott, but I'll say boycott. You know, but yes, but there are ways in which I don't purchase anything where I'm not respected. So if I go into a restaurant, any place, and I'm not respected, I'm not giving them my money again. And that's the way I believe that you could have your own personal protest. Remember, we're going to talk about the fact that protests could be out in the street, but Rosa Parks led a protest of one person. And her protest is internationally known just for not giving up her seat. So whether or not a person is taking a knee or a fist in the air or whatever it may be, or just saying no or saying yes, survival can be protest. Maintaining hope can be protest. There are so many ways in which protests can happen. I want it to be on the street when you can, but it could also be very individualized to your particular situation.
We had walkouts at schools over the funding of public schools. You know, there's all sorts of ways to just say, I dissent, I disagree, I object, I do not, this is not my America, I want a different America. There's lots of ways to do that.
There's lots of ways to do it, and we can agree to disagree, but in the end, you have to follow your own value system. And the longer one of the callers said, you know, if the longer you keep that stuck inside of you, you've got to feel like this weight. And it needs to come out, and it can in a peaceful manner as people come together into the streets and come together in a voice saying to the government that we will not allow this to happen. And this is as old as next year will be our Declaration of Independence, 250 years. The Declaration of Independence is a protest document in and of itself. That we need to understand protest is American. It's been this way all of this time. We can't just turn and say, if you're not saying what I want you to say, it is not a true protest.
Protest is patriotic. Let's go to Kitty on the phones. And Kitty, thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Thank you. I am a native San Antonian. I'm a native Texan. I'm a fifth generation Army brat. And I'm going to be out there at Travis Park from 5 to 8 p.m. this Saturday night on June 14th, Flag Day, and I'm going to be protesting what's happening to our country. I would like to suggest to people that they get on their phones, and I have my congressmen and our senators, both federal and state, on my push button to contact when I find out something's going on. Like one representative wanted to start to take down Texas parks this year, the legislature. Heard about it on your radio program. I was outraged. By the time I could figure out how to get to it, they'd already voted him down in the Texas legislature. But the power of the people is true, and we've just got to get out there. I've never been to a protest like this before, and I'm going to try and bring a sign. And I'm taking the park and ride bus down because I don't want to drive, and the traffic's going to be horrendous with all the construction going on. But there are ways to do it. And I really appreciate you suggesting have a lawyer's name in my pocket.
Well, hopefully you won't need it.
Jail.
Well, Kitty,
God willing, we're not going to do it. Thank you.
Kitty, thank you for calling in. So Gloria, is shaming the purpose of a protest, and what good is that against someone like Donald Trump?
Well, Donald Trump has no shame that we have been able to recognize him to this point. You know, maybe the fact that he's not as rich as he says he is may be a point of shame, and that's why he covers it up, but it's not the way we look at shame. I don't think shaming is the point of protest. It's bringing light to an issue of oppression. That to me is protest, so that oppressive element can be changed, and showing, if it's one person with a sign in front of a federal building, for example, saying that the voting rights have been taken away, that's bringing light to an issue that other people outside might not have known about. And it's using the power of the individual. We talk about lawyers, and my background's in law. We can talk about legislative people and all of that. But to know that you as an individual have the power, physical power, whether or not the person's in a wheelchair. And I've had protests that I've been participating in, and people were on crutches there. It's the ability to use what you have been naturally given to stand up and bring attention to an issue that you believe is wrong. That is the protest part of it, not just shaming, saying shame on you. That can be an element, that could be a way in which the message is delivered. But I think the message itself is that something wrong is happening here, and the government or a corporation or whomever is doing it, and we're going to shine light on it until it's changed.
In your book, you go through 400 years of protest, how it has been instrumental in shaping the America. You also talk about the conflicted America, that the Declaration of Independence was written with a quill in one hand, but with a lash in the other, that America is constantly in conflict. And so how does protest enter into trying to resolve that conflict?
Well, if people come to the country, and I've seen this a lot with immigrants, they're like, well, what we were told was about liberty and justice, but what we're seeing is empire building and corporate mindset. And that's the United States of America. It was conflicted from the very beginning. And I talk about that, is the idea that you have this United States, which is empire building, very corporate, about greed and avarice. And then you have America, which is the symbol of the Statue of Liberty, saying, bring me your poor. So these two conflicted parts of the American personality is constant. I say the United States gives us the reason why we protest, and America gives us the right to protest. So this is taking place the entire time, and we're always dealing with one side of the personality or the other. It's a very conflicted nation, has been conflicted from its beginning.
Well, we're almost out of time here, but when we have elections, I mean, that seems to be where it really matters. So, I mean, if people, you know, vote one way and we end up with these representatives, and why protest if this is where we are?
Well, we also have voter suppression. And voter suppression has been in place since 1870, when the 15th Amendment was ratified and Black men gained the right to vote. The vote of people of color is very powerful. And so voter suppression against that vote and political power of women, of young people, students, you know, so much is happening right now to suppress that vote. And so, yes, there are people who are voting, and then voting has consequences. But voter suppression has also been a part of the American experience and can't be ignored.
And you say, wait for 2045. What happens in 2045?
In 2045, this nation is going to be majority people of color. And that needs to be discussed, because what's happening right now is the creation of an apartheid state, so that by the time we get to 2045, there will still be a white patriarchic system in which certain people, especially conservative white older males, stay in place. I have nothing against conservative white older males. I do have something against oppression. And so by 2045, the demographic change is something that people are looking at right now and fearful of. And so the laws...
And that explains why things are happening now the way they are.
That exactly. Because people are wondering, well, why are they doing this? But that's because of 2045.
Okay.
Fear of the demographic changes that are going to take place.
Out of
and
time.
So that's what you're seeing right now happening in the country. The foundation. And that's what we
Gloria,
have to
Gloria Brown Marshall, thank you so much. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.